the week of June 20th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 59, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And standing on a street corner right outside Community, the coffee and tea shop in Long Island City, I'm Michael Gills.
And literally, you are standing outside, so when we hear either gunshots or a truck roll by, that will be from your mic.
I'm in Long Island City. There will be no gunshots here. We're a booming, bustling neighborhood, and one of the hottest neighborhoods in New York City, I should might add.
So when we hear the real estate agent walk past you, that'll be you.
That's exactly right. It's really annoying. There are so many people here now. It really sucks. It's serious. The rents are up, and it's not good. I used to walk out of the subway and be alone. Now, like, crowds of people get off at my stop, and it just drives me nuts. But it's literally 2 minutes from Grand Central, 5 minutes from Times Square. It's on the 7 train, first stop in Queens. Why it never developed before, I don't know, but now it's finally exploded.
Well, you're dealing with loads of people. We're dealing with loads of entertainment news stories. And if entertainment and the entertainment industry is your thing, if it really floats your boat, and we're assuming, by the way, that it does since you're listening, then we've got a great show for you today. A little later in the episode, we're going to be talking with producer Cotty Chubb, whose latest film, Unthinkable, stars Samuel L. Jackson and Michael Sheen. It was being hailed by audiences earlier this month as a brilliant film. The only problem with that is the film hadn't been released yet. We're also going to tell you how much money Michael Jackson's estate has made in the year since his death. In our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, we've got all the week's top headlines, including one about a potential director for The Hobbit after Guillermo del Toro dropped out, and a story about why some folks in Hollywood think the Internet Movie Database is ageist. Finally, during Inside Baseball, we'll talk about box office tracking, what it's all about, and why it seems to be unreliable this summer. The only thing we may not have time for is our listener email sent to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, but keep sending in your comments because we're figuring out a way to get them into each episode. And of course, as always, we turn to the show over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to tell us about the week, or I should say weekend's, big box office.
Pixar, Pixar, Pixar.
And that's all you have to say. And
all right,
the next
moving on.
I have a lot to say. You know, I just saw the billboard ad campaign for Toy Story 3. I kept missing it, but it proves how iconic the film is. Literally, walking down the street, you would just see a billboard. It would just have Woody or Buzz and the number 3. And that was it. And the date. That is all they needed. That tells you how big and iconic a movie Toy Story is, what a great franchise it is. And Toy Story 3 opened to rave reviews and $109 million over the three-day weekend. It's the highest Pixar film ever, by far, and one of the 10 top-grossing opening weekends of all time. Everything else paled in comparison, but at number 2 was The Karate Kid, which held really well, especially considering Toy Story 3 is a massively family-friendly film. Karate Kid made $29 million. It's at $106 million after 2 weeks. The A-Team did okay, made $13 million. It's at about $50 million total. Get Him to the Greek is actually holding up pretty well. That made $6 million. It's at $47 million total for a movie that cost $40 million to make. Shrek Forever After, you know, it's at $222 million in the U.S. Yeah, it costs $165 million to make, but it's going to make $500-plus million worldwide when all is said and done. Prince of Persia, that's at a pretty sad $80 million total in the U.S. But again, it's made $213 million overseas. So again, this might pull its bacon out of the fire. Killers is disappearing quickly. That's made $39 million total. That's the anonymous hit gangster-type comedy that's very similar to Night and Day, the Tom Cruise movie opening up in a week or two. Jonah Hex was the really bad news of the week. It's a comic book western starring Josh Brolin. Bad reviews, bad grosses. It opened to $5 million total. Iron Man 2 has passed $300 million, and Marmaduke has just passed $25 million. And that's it for the top 10, but it's all about Toy Story 3. I certainly saw it. Sperling, did you see it, Karen?
Well, of course, I've seen it already. I'm going to see it in 3D this weekend.
Don't.
Why not? I saw it in 2D originally.
Don't see it in 2D. I went to see the movie at Ewok, the Regal Cinemas theater chain in Times Square. It's one of the top grossing spots in the country, if not the top grossing. It's a massive 25-screen place. They only had one showing at midnight, and that was at their RPX Cinema, which is their Regal premium experience, 3D IMAX-like movie theater going experience. So, you know, whatever. You know how they had the big brouhaha about $20 movie ticket prices, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This was $19.
Well,
$19.
Yeah, well, it was IMAX, too, so that...
It's not IMAX. It was IMAX-like.
Okay. It was
similar. It's awesome screen, awesome sound, awesome 3D, but $19. So I go into this theater. It's at the end. It's their big screen, which they've had always, and they've had it for a while. I've been to that screen before. It wasn't branded RPX, but it is now. It has blue neon lights above the entrance to that particular cinema. I walk in. It's like a big screen. It's like any other. It's what you would expect for the big premium screen at a movie theater, right? $19. It was ridiculous. It was about half full, and people loved the movie. They applauded twice towards the end, but absolutely not necessary to see in 3D. I don't think, you know, I'm. It's like color or sound, you know. Yeah, it's there. They shot it to be seen in 3D, but it's very subtle, and it's not. I'm sure there are some touches that I didn't appreciate that were subtle that were done. But I honestly think you should see it in 2D for as little money as possible. There's no need to upgrade and spend all that money to see it in 3D. It's certainly not the RPX experience, which I will never do again.
Well, I saw it in 2D, and the film wasn't even finished, so there were whole scenes where there was no background, and it was just characters on screen, and it wasn't in color, and it had people in tears at the end. So,
oh my God, it's very moving.
Yeah,
it's
it
really
is.
Moving.
And I know, Karen, you probably will never see this film since, you know, it is done with ink and paint, but it is a very good film.
Yeah, my friend said it was better than the first one, but not as good as the second, which is probably what I would say. It was it felt a little repetitive at the start, like hitting some notes we'd already seen, but then it had great action scenes in the middle, a very moving scene where they sort of face death. There's a little sex in there with Ken and Barbie and other people dating, and very moving finale. It was a very good movie. It'll definitely be on my best of the year list.
Well, I love that line where Barbie kind of turns to Ken and says, "Oh, Ken, you've got a nice ass, Scott."
I do think that the writing in these movies is very clever. I just can't sit through a cartoon for 2 hours.
Well, I think it's only 90 minutes, if that helps.
No.
Well, you know, just to show you how bad the attendance is at movies this summer, Up opened last year to $68.1 million on 929 fewer 3D screens. And, of course, it made less money. But Shrek 3 opened in 2007 to $122.5 million with no 3D screens. So,
but Shrek is the biggest animated franchise of all time by far.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
You know, so you're comparing apples to oranges. This is a big improvement over the last Toy Story. It's their biggest opening by far, and Pixar is as close to a brand name as you can get. Now, what I don't understand is you have a notice down here about people saying they're taking bets on whether it will pass Finding Nemo and gross, you know, over 300, and how much is it?
So you must be referring to whether it will end up doing what most Pixar films do, which is basically quadrupling their opening weekend box office. So that would put it somewhere around $450 million, just ahead of, I guess it was, well, Nemo made $339.7 million domestically. And I guess the question is, will it beat Shrek 2 domestically? And that made $441 million. Will it become Pixar's most, well, not necessarily profitable film, but will it be the most successful film that Pixar has? I couldn't answer that.
Define the difference.
Well, just on pure gross alone.
I think it will absolutely pass Finding Nemo. It's open to 109 million. Their movies always have legs. There's no way it won't pass 330 million. It's gotten tremendously good reviews. They were saying, oh, gee, maybe people already saw it who want to see it. No, it's just adults went Thursday night. It's going to have a great hold. It's going to have great legs. And their movies are incredibly consistent, I must say. They almost always make 200 to 300 million in the U.S. and at least 500 to 600 million worldwide. This one will absolutely do that. And I firmly believe with opening to 109 million, there's no reason to think it's too front-loaded because everybody who sees it loves it and wants to see it again.
Well, it made $41 million on Friday, which is a record opening day, not weekend, opening day for an animated film. And there was some concern early on in the weekend, I think it was Saturday or early Sunday, that the film dropped about 10% from Friday to Saturday, which rarely happens with animated films because, of course, parents and their children can go to matinees on Saturday and Sunday. So usually the gross goes up from Friday to Saturday. And so,
but I think this is summer and people wanted to see this movie and adults are seeing it more than just families. So I think it has that much more of a draw for adults. And that's why the Saturday drop was, you know, slightly more than you would expect.
Well, I would normally agree with that, but what it wound up being was the fact that they counted all those midnight shows, like the one you saw, Michael.
Which was all adults.
Yeah. Right, and they counted it on Friday's gross, so that was really the difference. It, basically, between Friday and Saturday, the gross was flat, and it didn't drop off when you don't count for Thursday.
But they say they're placing bets. Anyone who wants to bet me that Toy Story 3 will not pass the domestic gross of Finding Nemo at $339 million. I will take that bet, give you 2-to-1 odds, you name your price.
You heard it here first. Michael Giltz over there in Long Island City, New
taking
York.
Bets. Taking Come to bets. My corner. What do you got?
Three-card Michael, we'll call you. I just made that up. So $44.8 million internationally, and this is what I think is interesting. Most of that gross came from Latin America and China. And what's interesting about China is usually China doesn't have a big gross because of piracy. You know, you show it once or twice, and somebody gets a camcorder version, and the next thing you know, everybody's buying it for a dollar on the street. But in this case, because of 3D, piracy is a little harder, and one of the big grosses for Toy Story 3 came out of China.
But why is piracy harder? Why wouldn't they just pirate the 2D version that was playing?
I'm sure they would, and probably did. However, most people would want to see it in 3D, because the 3D aspect of it was marketed so heavily.
If you're pirating, who cares?
Buying a camcorder version on the street for a buck, I don't think you give a damn whether it's in 3D.
Well, maybe not. I mean, actually, this is a nice little way to get into our guest, who is Cotty Chubb, and I guess I should give him a call. And Michael, while you are off seeing Toy Story 3 this weekend, I saw a little film called Unthinkable. And on the weekend of June 11th, if you visited the popular Internet Movie Database, or IMDb, you may have noticed a film that was ranked at number 4, higher than Get Him to the Greek, Shrek Forever After, and several other new titles. The funny thing is, this film isn't playing in theaters, and at the time, it hadn't even been released on DVD. Unthinkable was the name of that film, of course, the film I just mentioned, and the story of how it wound up at the top of IMDb's movie meter was detailed recently by Patrick Goldstein of the Los Angeles Times in his column The Big Picture. Depending on what your take is on the convergence of technology and the motion picture industry, it's a story that will either fascinate you or scare you into switching professions. To fill us in on that story, we have with us Cotty Chubb, the film's producer and the producer of such films as Eve's Bayou, To Sleep With Anger, and Appaloosa, just to name a few. Mr. Chubb, thank you for joining us.
Oh, pleased to be here. I was an executive producer on Appaloosa, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, can you tell us...
By the way, I really like that movie. I just finished reading the book, and the movie is wonderfully faithful to it.
Yeah.
Good movie people should rent.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what Unthinkable, the story of Unthinkable, what it's about?
Well, it's a pretty simple little idea for a movie, in a way. It's a ticking bomb movie. A guy has planted three nuclear bombs and has an agenda. And that character is played by Michael Sheen. Carrie Ann Moss is an FBI agent who is tasked with discovering where the bombs are. And Samuel Jackson is, there's a little dialogue in the movie about whether he's a contractor or a subcontractor. He's a torturer, and he has one question: where are the bombs? There is conflict between each of those. At least it takes place in a secure location, apparently the gymnasium of an abandoned high school, where they have brought in a chamber where the work happens. And the essence of the story is this triangle of three people, each with their own agendas, with no particular and the struggle between each between H and Brody, the FBI agent, about what's the right thing to do, her efforts to get Younger or Yusuf, the so-called terrorist, to reveal the sites of the locations of the bombs, and the struggle between Yusuf and H to resist the torture that he's undergoing.
And it's a pretty gruesome torture. I mean, it's not
NC-17 rated, but there's some striking moments in it, but not, we tried to stay, it's not torture porn. We tried to stay away from that sort of thrilling, excruciating, peel the skin off them kind of stuff.
You see a little bit
of that, but it's pretty unpleasant. It's not fun.
It's not the Disney style porn that you're used to, Sperling. It's actual torture that makes you feel like it's actually happening. And so it should be upsetting.
Right. It asks the moral question, really, of is this kind of torture allowable in this situation when you have tens of millions of people's lives on the line? I mean, is that okay?
It raises all of those questions, but we worked actually quite hard to not have it certainly marketed or perceived in that way as a quote political movie. I wanted it to work first as a suspense movie with characters that just ratchets that tension up till you think you're going to explode. And I think it actually does that kind of well.
Well, and you got a great cast. And obviously we know that when people saw the movie, they really enjoyed it. So what happened on your journey as far as trying to get it out to the world? Because we know that there were films perceived as political, like Rendition in the Valley of Elah, that didn't do well. So were studios sort of thinking, oh...
Yeah, you know, no, there was a lot of... It made me quite angry then, and it frankly makes me quite angry now, that people were tarring it with that brush because it so clearly wasn't that. It so clearly was a ticking bomb movie. I, with all respect to my friends who've made Rendition, I wouldn't be able to cut a trailer to that, but I can cut a trailer to Unthinkable. This, I thought, was a commercial notion, and would do this strange thing of putting people in shoes they were not comfortable being in, whether you're coming at this from the left or from the right. And I'm seeing this on the message boards on IMDb Pro, because there's a lot of talk on the message boards about piracy and about how the movie got started and all that stuff. Questions that I was asking of these people, but who are downloading the movie perfectly happily in the tens and hundreds of thousands, as far as I could tell, without paying for it. But there's also this extensive discussion about right and wrong. Like, it's astonishing. It's just as though the audience was actually intelligent, which is an assumption that studios aren't comfortable making.
Did the Hurt Locker's Academy Award for Best Picture help at all when you were trying to sell this to studios?
No, the movie was sold long since. And it's interesting. That's an interesting question, too, but that touches on the piracy question. But it had nothing to do with us. We got the movie financed by a combination of private equity, a bank financing it against foreign estimates and foreign sales, which were strong. It had been originally developed at Kimmel, and Kimmel International had taken it into the foreign marketplace and gotten a very, very good response to it. And Sony, which bought television and video, home entertainment, so-called. The problem happened in that the company that was supposed to, and as part of this deal, supply the prints and ads, collapsed, partly from an unforgiving economic climate where it was very difficult to raise money, and partly from what seemed to me to be clumsy business practices.
And that was Senator Films, we should say.
Yeah. So when they collapsed, the movie was left with no P&A. And all the rights are spoken for. So the only way you can raise money on that is to say, well, if you put up the money for the P&A, you'll get it back out of theatrical. And it's a one picture deal where you can only recoup from theatrical. Sony was very nice and generous, and they wanted it to work, and they sort of bent the terms of their deal to try and entice someone into coming to take that risk. But the thought was, and I'll speak really briefly here because it's business, that if you put up $5 million in P&A, you might not make it back, because it really is a Sam Jackson ticking bomb movie. You need to spend some money to get that movie out there. And if you put up $10 million, you probably could get it back, but we couldn't raise the $10 million.
Well, now, so what you're saying is, if the foreign rights hadn't already been sold and Sony didn't have it for home video and television, it very well may have been a little bit more attractive to another domestic distributor here in North America.
Yeah, but then I wouldn't have gotten the movie made.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of a catch-22.
No movie to sell, so yeah.
I mean, you always hear about those films like Slumdog Millionaire, where they say, oh, it almost went straight to DVD. Well, I guess, you know, for every film like Slumdog Millionaire that actually makes it into theaters, there's one that wasn't so lucky.
Steve Burrish at Sony has a wallet full of orphaned theatricals, busted theatricals. Absolutely. There's quite a few. The thing that's interesting and the thing that's unique about Unthinkable is the fact that it drove actually to number the week before it was number 4, it was actually number 3 on IMDb, because a very high quality digital file got out and hit the torrent and streaming sites 3 weeks before any commercial release. So on the IMDb meter, it's tracking along at, you know, 3,200, 3,400, 3,800, 3,100, whatever. And then it jumps to 862. And then the next week it jumps to number 3. So we were the beneficiary, if you can call it that, of remarkable word of mouth. Because the only way people are hearing about this movie is by people who have downloaded and saying, you got to see this thing. It's great.
And do you know how it leaked onto the internet? And how were you made aware that a pirated copy was out there?
I'm sorry, I went on the message boards on IMDb, and I went on, I went on the torrent sites and I went on the streaming sites, and there it is in like 15 different versions, including a really high quality version. There's subtitled versions. There's, you know, every movie's out there. You want to go see Salt? Don't wait. You can go on the torrent sites now and see Salt.
Who is Salt, by the way, anyway?
that's the advertising campaign. I actually downloaded it off the internet. However, I did so legally. It's available on Amazon Unbox, which is now Amazon Video on Demand for $3.99. It's also available on iTunes to purchase. You can buy the DVD.
It's number 12 on iTunes.
Yes, and that's what I was going to say, or ask, I should say. A year or so ago, Monty Python released all of their films for free.
Right, I know about that.
Onto the internet. Their sales of DVDs skyrocketed 200%.
I don't think they actually released all of their films for free. I don't think that that's true. But I could be wrong about this. I thought what they did was they created a Monty Python channel on YouTube, and they put up really high-quality clips of the Monty Python stuff on YouTube, which had been poor versions, you know, bad quality, junky, chunky, not so good. And they put up the clips for free on YouTube and said, go have at it. And also made their library available for pay download. I don't believe they put up the full films for free.
You're absolutely right. That's exactly what they did, which was smart because they were already being pirated out there. And it was something that could be presented in clip form. So it was a savvy business move, but it was their decision to make. What I love is all the people who grapple with the right and wrong of your movie Unthinkable and the issues that it raised and had fun at watching this thriller, but they couldn't grapple with the question of whether it was right for them to steal it in the first place.
Well, there was a lot of grappling with that question. I put up a thread called, I started a thread on the message board called What's the Right Price?
It got quite a bit of a response, in fact.
Quite a bit. And I also started a thread sort of provocatively going, wow, Unthinkable number 3 on IMDb. And ask these questions. That has 139 entries on it on that thread. So there is a lot of back and forth on it, and it's been fascinating. The reasons, some of which are just, I think, lousy excuses for being a shoplifter, and some of which are you listen and you think, oh, okay, I get where you're coming from.
I'm just gonna say, like what? Can you give some examples of some good reasons?
Some of them are, I'm in Mozambique, and this is the only way I could see it. I am in a Muslim country, and this would never, ever be shown here or be shown with such censorship that I would never be able to see this movie where I am. Okay, that's reasonable. I feel like I've been ripped off too many times. I'm not going to spend $15 or $20 on a movie without testing to see whether I like it first, because I don't have any way to know whether – this is my pretest. But, you know, it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't really matter what the excuse is, because the fact is they're out there.
Right.
And the business is, the movie business itself is going to have to come to terms somehow with this. Now, today on the boards, you know, somebody was talking about, look how Hurt Locker was helped by all of this. By all of the publicity that it was released and nobody really cared about it, and then we drove it to all of this great success. And what did he say? Let's see if it's this guy. Yeah, I remember downloading it, watching it, loving it, and wonder why I've never seen any marketing or press. Almost 2 years later, we all know how the story eventually unfolded. I realize the circumstances are a bit different with Unthinkable, but hey, I'm just saying. The Academy's Best Picture of 2010 was leaked online in a similar fashion, a high-quality copy that allowed millions of people to watch it who probably never would have known it otherwise. And it's sort of like, and that's why it won the Academy Award.
Well, yeah, but it also made $12 million, and it was the lowest grossing movie since, I think, the 1960s to win the Best Picture. So,
right, and what I said, so I responded to that guy and said, well, yeah, you know, that's great. It did, I think it did actually close to $15 million, but... And DVD sales are nothing. So the millions of people that watched also siphoned off revenues from people all over the world. You know, he's saying that all those millions of people, quote, who probably never would have known about it otherwise, they're not members of the Academy. They don't vote. And their millions of downloads don't influence people who do vote, like me.
But the millions of people who heard about it when it won the Oscar and might have wanted to see it, they'd already seen it and they paid nothing for it. So there's a lot of sort of self, in my read of what's going on this, on the self-selected group of people who are talking on IMDb about piracy, is that there's a lot of self-justification about, you know, hey, it's free marketing. And it is kind of, but it's not marketing in my control. When Fox Searchlight screens their films to, you know, 100 screenings before they release, and thereby giving away, what, 30,000 tickets to make sure that people have seen the movie, they're choosing to do that. And they're choosing who sees it. But this millions of downloads, it's not clear to me that piracy equals free publicity, and that's how positive to the filmmakers.
Yeah, so like Chris Anderson's book, Free, which isn't, I think, if it's not on the bestseller list, it was. I mean, his whole thing is, you know, if you give something away, you actually can reap rewards down the road in some other form. You're saying,
Greg, did he give that book away free? Because I don't think so.
He did, actually, for a little while, not forever.
For a little while.
Yeah.
But to make a point.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one commenter suggested something that Radiohead has tried, which is putting up a donation button where people could pay what they wanted via maybe something like PayPal. Did you give this any thought, and do you think...
Well, no, actually, Greg Jordan, the director, did set that up, and he set up a site where if you had downloaded it and you wanted to send some money to Gregor, you could.
And how many people actually did that?
You know, he hasn't... I know one person did for $28.48, but she was an Australian girl, she said, and she was trying to support Australian directors. I doubt it was very much. It caused problems for Sony and for the bank. The foreign sales, the bank that was dealing with foreign sales, because they've collected money from people who are licensing the movie, whether it's iTunes or whether it's, you know, in France. And to have someone else out there in some fashion encouraging, sort of acting like he could license the movie.
I see what you're saying.
And receive revenue for it was just an awkward situation. Radiohead can do that because it's not like...
They own the music.
Because they own it, but Gregor didn't own it. I don't own the movie. The movie's owned by the people who paid for it.
And are sales going well?
You know, that's I need to ask that question of Sony. I mean, I assume if it's number 12 on iTunes, that's not bad, considering they're not really spending very much money marketing and it had no theatrical release. I mean, most of the time, if you take a movie out theatrically, whether you're spending $10 million or $40 million, you're creating awareness of the title and possibly a want to see, even for people who don't see it in the theaters, they go, oh yeah, I really wanted to see Book of Eli with Denzel Washington, but I never went to the theater, but I know what it is, and I like that Denzel Washington, so I'm going to download it. But if you have $0 spent for that, I think getting to number 12 on iTunes is pretty good. But,
well, yeah, and I can tell you, I attended the LA Film Festival's marketing and distribution symposium.
Well, how was that?
It was really fascinating, and they talked a lot about hybrid distribution and the different models around it. Really, I mean, my head was spinning by the time I left. It was a five-hour symposium on Saturday and another 5 hours on Sunday.
Yeah. Those are smart guys. Ted was there, probably Ted Hope and John Reese and a bunch of people that are interesting, smart people.
Yes, very much so.
And grappling with this stuff. And I really recommend anybody who's listening to you to also be on Ted Hope's blog.
Hammered and Ill.
Truly Free Film.
That's another
one,
because
he does a lot of... He posts stuff every day from different people about this stuff.
Now, do you think that given your experience this time around, that you would actually try and experiment with hybrid distribution in the future?
Yeah, if I can make a movie for $150,000, but this costs 11.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I can.
So,
I can.
You know, yeah, sure. The trick is to, again, make a movie that the audience needs or wants to see, and then they'll pay for it. Or they'll see it. If there's something about it that seems like a positive economic transaction, then there's a reason to do it. And they will pay for it. You know, a lot of people will steal it, but a lot of people will pay for it if they're being treated fairly. I mean, the music business has shown this to some degree, you know? I mean, you can steal music. It's super easy. But iTunes sells of music. The model is kind of there, but the stuff has to be cheap. And it has to have something about it that the audience says, hey, I want to see that.
Well, and just to give you some sense, I mean, I did pay for it on Amazon. I downloaded it to my TiVo. And then I thought, well, you know, I also should see what the quality is of the pirated version. And so I downloaded the pirated version, and then I thought, okay.
Which one? Because there's like 20.
Oh, I have no idea which one. I mean, I couldn't even begin to tell you. But then I said, okay, I want to see what it's like to try and get it from my computer onto an iPad. And so it took me some finagling, and now I know how to do it, but and it's not easy. Unless you buy certain programs, which I did not.
Mean the legitimately downloaded Amazon one you couldn't see on your iPad?
No. The pirated one.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of work.
Yeah, and then I did it, and I was like, well, okay, I could see if you had a little bit of know-how, this isn't so hard. I mean, it took some education, but ultimately,
next time you do it, it'll be easier.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to do it again.
You know what to do, and you bought the software, and it's fine. If I, funny, if I were Sony, I'd put out lots of dubs of something that appeared to be unthinkable and just lace them with viruses.
Well, and they, that used to happen.
They do that a lot with music and movies, yeah.
Well, finally, do you think that this incident will actually affect your ability to make movies in the future?
I don't know. It drove my listing much higher on IMDb than it used to be.
Oh, congrats.
So in a way, all this positive publicity.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I can make the argument to somebody that you should trust my interpretation of what movies are going to be successful because look what happened here. But do you really think that's going to have any effect? I don't. I don't think that's – no. If I made a movie that did – if I made a movie for $11 million that did $60 million at the box office, yeah, that's a metric they understand.
Well, Cotty, thank you for joining us. We should point people to your, your Twitter account, which is Chubco, right?
Yeah, it is.
And, of course, you can purchase Unthinkable on iTunes, as you mentioned, on Amazon. I noticed that it was in Walmart.
Yeah, the Blu-ray and the DVD are out now. They're out and available, and they're even better than you can get for free online. And they have special features.
Yes, and you don't have to spend 8 hours of your life trying to get it onto an iPad.
I will say the streaming sites are, I'm told, very good, but you have to get the right version. There's an incredibly high resolution version out there. I mean, it's the movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's unnerving. Anyway, or go on the message boards on IMDb Pro, because that conversation is still ongoing. I mean, there's 30 posts a day. About the rights and wrongs of the movie and the rights and wrongs of piracy. It's an interesting conversation to be part of, at least it is for me.
We'll place a link to it in the show notes.
Okay, take care.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Well, when he asked people what price is fair, the answer is whatever price he decides. The point is you don't get to decide if you're the user. You don't get to steal it and decide what price is fair.
No, unfortunately, you're wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to say, Michael, I mean, in an age where copying things digitally, there is no cost to it. I would have to disagree with the fact that there is no cost to it and that nobody pays. It's not free. Somebody has to pay for the wires going to your house. Somebody has to pay for internet access. And all of that costs money. And so when you pay your $40 for cable, part of what you're paying for is the increased traffic load to Time Warner or Comcast or whoever your internet service provider is for all of these people who are downloading free music and free movies.
I do think it seems like more and more for small movies that they're just going to have to make it available as quickly as possible in a fair digital form that you can buy at a reasonable price and download easily, because then people won't go to the bother. Because obviously for movies that aren't going to come to your city or your country in theatrical release, there's no reason to delay. If you're going to release something in 20 cities, why keep it from the other, 5,000 cities around the globe?
Yeah, and that's kind of what this symposium was at the LA Film Festival. It really was fascinating. I guess I can place a link to that in the show notes as well. It's already occurred, so I don't necessarily know what benefit it will be. Ted Hope, who has appeared on this show, was one of the speakers, and he gave a fascinating talk. There were several other little panel discussions that were interesting. A lot is going on in that area that I was completely unaware of.
So the result is go watch Unthinkable legally.
Yes, and there are many ways to actually do it. I mean, you don't have to download it illegally. Well, you never have to download something illegally, but in this case, there really are very inexpensive ways to see this film.
Yeah, I love it when they say, oh, but I'm told people about it. It's like saying you go to a restaurant and you walk out there paying your bill, like, yeah, but I'm going to tell everyone what a great movie it was.
Well, we have to thank him. Thank Kadi Chubb for joining us. His film is Unthinkable. We'll place links to everything in the show notes. I guess we should move on to music. And this week, we're going to be talking about Michael Jackson. It's been a year since it's been a year.
Oh, my God.
Wow. You know, okay then.
Oh my God.
Either you're near a very talented street performer or you are getting us into the Michael Jackson mood.
We're channeling Michael from the dead.
Well, and that's where I was headed. It's been a year since he passed away or died. Hard to believe it's been that long. It seems like it was maybe just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, it does seem fast. But I have to say, the story you linked to in Billboard magazine is jaw-dropping. Can I run through the numbers for people?
Absolutely. Feel free, because these numbers, and by the way, there is no way we can go through all of them. Yeah. Basically, what this is saying, and then I guess I'll turn it over to you, Michael, to fill us all in, is that Michael Jackson really is worth more dead than alive. He made $1 billion last year.
Yeah, that is truly saying. It's not that he's worth more dead than alive, but he certainly, because, you know, he would have recorded more music and therefore his estate would have been worth even more when he eventually died at 90. So let's not get morbid. It's not like it would have been worth less if he'd lived another 30 years. But I find this jaw-dropping. Music sales over the past year, including album and CD sales in around the world, digital tracks, ringtones, $429 million. On film, including selling the rights to his, you know, concert film, which is the biggest grossing concert film of all time, which I was completely wrong about. Michael Jackson, This Is It, releasing that around the world, selling that on DVD in Japan, all over. The total for that is, I don't see the film total, but it's, where is that? Where is it? Do you see it?
No, I forgot to put it in.
Let's go back and look and see what it is. And touring, he could have made a ton of money. But the funny thing is, he had a show scheduled at the O2 concert, a 50-show run of nights. And they made $6 million by fans who kept their ticket because they didn't want to turn it in and get a refund. And they wanted the ticket as a souvenir. And that's just unbelievable. So what stuns you most about this, bro?
Well, I mean, he made $5 million in ringtones alone. I mean, it's all of these little tiny revenue streams that were coming in. You know, $34 million for digital tracks, which kind of tells you why the music industry hates digital music, and that's because they don't make as much money on it. So
but Michael Jackson sold 9 million albums in the US last year. The Jackson 5 and the Jackson sold almost a million units of them. Overseas, they sold 24 million CDs last year. It's unbelievable. 33 million CDs in the past year. That's stunning. I mean, if you're lucky to sell 3 million, if you sell 3 to 4 million copies last year, you're the top grossing artist in the world.
Yeah.
And he sold 33 million copies. That's unbelievable. It's like the last wow of the CD era. That's funny because I was reading this story about a record store owner who said when Michael Jackson died, every vagrant, every bum on the street came into the store with their scratched, beat-up LP of Michael Jackson's throat and says, I want 50 bucks. I want 50 bucks. And the guy eventually had to put a display of all the Michael Jackson albums he had in the window. So he'd go, buddy, look, I got a million of them. Trust me. They go for $7. You're not getting $50. You're not getting 50 bucks.
Well, did you see how much he made in Japan just on the film This Is It?
And the DVD sales in the first day were $18 million for that film. The movie grossed $56 million, so you're looking at $75, $80 million in Japan for movie and DVD sales alone. And obviously they bought a ton of CDs as well. You also had another story about it's sort of morbid, about what he did the last day of his life.
The Associated Press put together, based on interviews with witnesses and documents that they researched through the police records, they put together an hour by hour and sometimes minute by minute account of his last day, all the way, I guess it started midday on the 25th, and he had a light lunch with his children, then went to rehearsal at the Staples Center. He returned home after rehearsing for his show, which was going to take place in London. And he couldn't fall to sleep, and that's where things started to go south. He was up all night and at 7 in the morning after taking numerous amounts of drugs that were given to him by Dr. Conrad Murray. He finally took the propofol, and of course, the rest is history. They went all the way into the hospital where he was pronounced dead, in fact.
Well, here's what this is kind of a non sequitur, but I thought it was interesting that AEG is going to pay for the security for the funeral.
Yeah, well, I guess that was a debate here in Los Angeles because...
Huge debate.
There was, you know, this memorial service cost close to $2 million, and certainly the city of Los Angeles, which is near broke, if not broke itself, has no money to pay for it. And so AEG finally said, you know, we'll pay for it a year later. But they said, you know, I guess we've made a lot of money off this guy. We'll pay.
Well, they also had the footage from the funeral that to put into the DVD on This Is It and all that stuff, didn't they?
Yes. And they made, you know, they made their money back for the concerts in London and from the This Is It film. And they made money off of merchandise. And they're making money off of that memorial, as you said. So they've made a lot of money. And 90% of the money from This Is It is going to go to the Jackson estate. So that is a lot of money.
Not 90% of the billion.
No. 90% of the box office gross from the concert film This Is It will go to the Michael Jackson estate.
90% of the box office gross went to the family?
To the estate, not to the family.
Well, to the estate? When was that deal made? Where does it say that?
It was in court documents, which indicate it could be as high as 90%.
Who made that? Nobody made that deal. That's crazy.
I'm sure it's net, not gross.
That means they got nothing.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, it's a sad anniversary, but...
Let's go play Thriller instead. And next year, I know Sony has a deal to release a bunch of unreleased stuff, but... Next year, a remastered version of Off the Wall, his second greatest album of all time. And I have to say, Dangerous and one or two others sounded better than I remembered. So the music is enduring.
Are you going to buy any of these reissues?
Oh, I'll buy. I own the Thriller reissue. I'll certainly get the Off the Wall remastered version. Yeah, not for the bonus or demo tracks, but just for the album. Yeah. You know, the four or five key albums of his, I'm sure I'll buy if and when they reissue them.
And now you own a lot of books. You're a big book reader. I know you take some out from the library, but you also purchase a lot of them. Will you be buying them again for your iPad or your iPhone or your Kindle?
No, absolutely not. That's crazy. You know, if I bought a book, I'm not going to pay extras for the luxury of having an ebook version. As you know, I've said repeatedly, I think they have to say, if they want to make hardcover sales exciting, when you buy a hardcover book, they should make you, for like a dollar maybe, be able to download the ebook and another dollar download the audiobook version. That's what the book industry needs to do. They've been floundering for years. I haven't even bought an iPad yet, or a Kindle, or a Nook.
I've been using an iPad for the past week, and I have to say, it's as much as I think it's a you-don't-really-have-to-have-it tool, it's really sweet. And you linked to a story.
Have you read on it?
Oh, yes, I have read on it. In fact, I read a very technical book on programming, so programming for the web, and I have the paperback version of the book, and inside the book it says, you know, you can get a free e-reader version of this book, an e-book.
See, that the manual people and the tech people are very smart about that. They've been offering that for the last few years.
Yeah, and they had this whole code that you had to enter based on the codes inside the book, but and I thought that was great.
Karen, would you ever buy a Kindle or a Nook or an iPad?
If I traveled, I would. But I'm still old school that I like to hold a book.
Well, you shouldn't have to make that choice. But what if it was cheaper?
You mean just in general or cheaper than a regular book?
Segue, Sperling.
Well, I thought we had already segued. We're talking basically about your story, Michael.
No, I know. The price. We didn't talk about the price war yet.
Yes, there is a price war between, thankfully, the iPad and the Kindle. So
no, the Kindle and the Nook.
The Kindle and the Nook. Sorry, I didn't read this properly, I suppose. But why don't you fill us in on it, Michael? You probably know a little bit
My
more
fault.
About
it. I
this.
Posted it up at the last minute. I just saw it in the paper. There's a price war because e-readers are fighting each other and they're looking fearfully over their shoulder at the wildly popular iPad. Barnes & Noble cut the price of the Nook to $199 on Monday morning, with a Wi-Fi-only Nook at $149. Monday afternoon, Amazon dropped the price of the Kindle to $189. Of course, iPads still cost $499 and up.
And when they start dropping in price, you know another one is on the way.
Well, that's what's so exciting, is that you know that this is indicative of something about to happen.
Oh, yeah. This
well,
is
Well, Google. It's Google's program, right? I mean, Google's opening an e-book store in like any day now or week now, and they're going to be offering ebooks that you can play on your Nook or your iPad or your Kindle or your laptop or any other device that comes up down the road, rather than buying something for your Kindle and finding out you're stuck with the Kindle and you can't switch it to something else, which is what they all do, and it's very annoying. So I think that's going to help a lot as far as price competition and getting them to open it up and make it, you know, if you buy a song, you should be able to play on any device you want.
Yeah, you know, and a couple points to what you've said, Michael. One, the Kindle and the Nook being $149 and $189 respectively. First of all, with the iPad out there in full color with all of its apps, these readers have to come down in price because there's no incentive whatsoever to buy them. All you can do with them is
read books. Like comparing an iPod to an iPhone. I mean, they're different devices.
Yes, indeed, but they are often touted as doing the same device.
People still buy iPods for $99, MP3 players for $100, $150. They don't expect you to make a phone call.
And the second thing is not a lot of people actually know about the Google Bookstore that is in the works and some say launching this summer. It has not been widely reported either in tech circles or in most circles. And only recently actually have a couple of news stories broken over the weekend, in fact.
That's why people listen to our podcast.
That's right. Google is supposedly working on something called News Pass, which will give you subscriptions to several different content outlets like the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. And we'll see how that develops.
I have to say, I had a sort of a sea change about the iPad, realizing that one of my friends who I go to the Yankee Stadium with, she does not write on her computer. She doesn't use her computer for anything but email and surfing the web. And I realized the iPad is absolutely perfect. She was asking if she should get it. I was like, actually, it's perfect for you. It's absolutely perfect.
Wait. What does she use to write on then?
She doesn't write. She's a nanny.
Oh, she's not a writer. Okay.
Yeah, she's not a writer. She works. She's a person. Like most people.
She's a person?
All she does is send emails and surf the web. You know, she's not programming. She's not a writer. She's not going to produce documents. She might send an email or maybe a letter. But, you know, basically, no. All she does with her computer is surf the web and check email 98% of the time. So for her, I realized, wow, the iPad is way better than a laptop. Should she buy a new laptop or the iPad? I said, get the iPad.
And I just filed a story on it for Celluloid Junkie. I typed a whole story on it just to see if I could, and then filed it with the WordPress application, resized the photo, and published it. So it is doable. You can do it.
Did you have a detachable keyboard, or did you just...
I do have a Bluetooth keyboard that I could have used. I did not want to do that on purpose. I wanted to test it out, so I used...
Oh, how did you ever do that?
With a little practice, it's not that hard.
It was no big deal for you. It was no big whoop for you to master that.
Yes, it was either no big deal, it was a big whoop. I don't know.
Segway alert.
Yes, that was a segue into our lightning round, our ever-popular big deal or big whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news headlines of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. I guess we should just get right into it. Our first story this week: if you're headed to the Olympics in London for 2012, don't forget to pack your tutu. Stephen Daldry, the director of Billy Elliot and Danny Boyle of Trainspotting and Slumdog Millionaire, have been tapped to follow in the footsteps of China's Zhang Yimou and oversee the opening ceremony. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is big. It's a big deal. You know, these are big name people, and it's just indicative of where we've gone in terms of our expectations for opening ceremonies.
Michael?
It's a big deal. It's fascinating that movie directors are suddenly the go-to guys for this sort of event.
And how do you like your Hobbit served? Perhaps with some prawns on the side? The rumor surrounding the two-part adaptation of The Hobbit is that South African director Neil Blomkamp, the man behind the Oscar-nominated smash District 9, is stepping into the shoes reluctantly vacated by Mexican director Guillermo del Toro. Michael, you're part Hobbit yourself. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'm still, you know, bummed that Guillermo del Toro's not doing it. I keep hoping he'll somehow come back into it. But, you know, again, Neil, just like Guillermo del Toro, has a lot of similarities to where Peter Jackson was when he made The Lord of the Rings. You know, he's made this sort of cheap, low budget, but very inventive movie, District 9, which was a lot of fun. And assuming he has the right passion for it, I guess it could work. So I guess it's a big deal. I'm scared. I'd rather have Peter Jackson step in, but obviously he doesn't want to do that.
No, he really does not. Karen?
Well, first, I thought it was interesting that you had to point out their nationalities in this. I agree with Michael. It's a big deal. And I think that this director can do it.
Well, I mentioned the nationalities because you've got New Zealander Peter Jackson, and then Mexican, and then South African, all telling a classic.
No, I know that's what I meant. I know that you did it for that reason, and I find that interesting.
I'm not xenophobic.
And that's not what I meant.
Moving on to Perez Hilton, who is gay, but he thinks it's funny to peek up the skirt of Miley Cyrus. Hilton linked to a photo of Cyrus getting out of a car that many people believed gave a glimpse of her privates. A suggestion that Hilton violated kiddie porn laws was even floated. Hilton says she got out of the car in an unladylike fashion. You didn't really see anything, so there. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Unfortunately, it is a big deal that has turned into a big whoop that has turned into a big deal again. We are so not affected by this kind of thing anymore. Within the past couple of years, what our society just doesn't seem to care, that the biggest deal here is that it has turned into a big deal, that we care again.
Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a fan of gossip or these trashy sites. I don't follow them. I don't look at them. And his argument that, oh, well, she got out of the car in a fashion that she must have known there were paparazzi present. He makes it sound like she was spreading her legs to give them a show or something. It's just the fact that there are people haunting her every step, the fact that they would post it online, it's just tiresome and embarrassing. And it's I wish it would end, but it never will.
And so it's a big deal?
It's a big deal.
Well, are you a fan of Soundgarden? You better get ready to buy the video game Guitar Hero Warriors of Rock, if you are. The seminal grunge rock band hasn't put out any new music since 1997, but there will be an unreleased track called Black Rain on the latest Guitar Hero release. That's just the latest coup for the video game franchise, which has reinvigorated the catalog of classic bands and been the source of some rare new music. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's interesting. It's just an unreleased track, but I want to hear Sperling say the name of the video game again.
You want me to say the name of the video game again?
Yeah, you did a great job.
Oh, it was Guitar Hero, Warriors of Rock.
Ooh, I like that.
Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Michael, what did you say? I don't think this is a big deal.
I said it was interesting, but it's a big whoop. But yeah, I liked how Sperling said Guitar Hero, Warriors of Rock.
Yeah, that's the biggest deal here.
The way I said the name? Okay, well then we should move on. Apparently, actress Amanda Bynes says about her career that, what I like about you? Nothing. That's right, the 24-year-old actress is retiring after 11 years in the business and parts in three hit series. The Nickelodeon sketch show All That, her own sitcom, The Amanda Show, and the sitcom What I Like About You with Beverly Hills 90210 vet Jenny Garth, which ran for four seasons. All of them were overseen by Nickelodeon mogul Dan Schneider. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, I think it's a big deal. Child actors rarely make the transition to adulthood. She's adorable. She was really good in her sketch shows as a kid. She's had a long run, and now she's saying goodbye. So a lot of people grew up with her, you know, onto What I Like About You, which I kind of liked. I love Jenny Garth. And bye-bye, Amanda. And she's leaving with her dignity intact. Let's put it that way.
Karen?
I would agree with you on that last bit. Yeah. My initial reaction was giggling because this was such a big whoop. But then coming at it from another perspective, exactly. I mean, she is leaving with her dignity intact, and it's really kind of a gutsy move.
And she's, well, you know, you get, you know, 11 years is a long time, but she also has a movie coming out.
Well, and her representation, her agents and managers and publicists have not confirmed this, and she did kind of announce this through a Twitter post at 3 a.m. in the morning, which may prove the old adage.
She was drunk?
Don't drink and tweet.
You don't know that she drank. Don't say that.
No,
she's Amanda
Bynes.
She's America's sweetheart.
Well, maybe she's upset that she's not on Glee. And isn't Glee basically a high school musical? So why not make it into an honest-to-goodness movie? No plans are in the works, but it is in the Fox contract that the stars of Glee must appear in up to three Glee feature films if Fox decides to do so. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Awesome. Neither. We don't know if it's true.
Okay. Michael?
It's a big whoop that there's some clause in their contract. It's interesting that a TV show would include that clause. And I also think it'd be awfully smart to make one. Why not?
Yeah, why not?
It was called High School Musical. They've already had three.
I think Glee would totally work. You know, you could do it in the summer. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it. I would say you run the show for four seasons and then turn it into a feature film. You don't want to do it in the middle of seasons, like a summer movie, and then a new fall season starts. That would kill it. But do it for four seasons on TV and then turn it into a feature film and make a lot more money. Why not?
And then it can be listed on IMDb. The Writers Guild is worried that if studios can find out how old a screenwriter is on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, they'll be more likely to dismiss them out of hand. IMDb says, hey, our information is accurate. Deal with it. Michael, who is 87 years old and has probably already forgotten what this item is about. So, Karen, let me ask you, is this WGA complaint a big deal or a big whoop?
I find it very interesting. Ultimately, I think it's a big whoop for now, but I do think it's something to keep your eye on.
Michael?
Where am I?
it's a big whoop, and the people being ageist are the WGA. Someone's age should not matter. It's a fact.
Oh, but it does.
In this town, baby.
Gary Marshall's,
it does matter
Gary Marshall's,
very much.
Gary Marshall just directed a $230 million box office smash, and he's 74 years old. Big deal.
It's the anomaly.
That brings us to our last segment, Inside Baseball, where we discuss only the stories that Hollywood might care about. This week, we're going to talk about The Trouble with Tracking, which was a story in The Wrap by Daniel Frankel. And he talks a lot about how tracking, which is a way for movie studios to figure out how their movies are doing in the minds of audiences and whether they are even on the minds of audiences in the weeks leading up to their release. Over Memorial Day weekend, Warner Brothers' Sex and the City was forecast to take in around $60 million, and it ended up making $36.8 million. A week earlier, DreamWorks Animation's Shrek Forever After was on track to do about $90 million, but it ended up opening to just $70.8 million. Then last weekend, the opposite happened with Sony's The Karate Kid. Its domestic opening beat the high end of pre-release forecast by a stunning $20 million. He says here, these days, studio executives are not the only ones to wonder why the opening predictions of research firms, to which they pay millions of dollars each year, are so frequently off. What do you think about this, Karen? I mean, I know when we were working at agencies, tracking was a huge deal, and you could only get it from one place, NRG.
Oh, well, lots changed for sure. What I thought was interesting was, who was it in this article that said, oh, well, we don't really use tracking to determine how much a movie's going to make. We use it to determine how the reach is changing, you know, how many people are actually finding out about it, which I'm not sure was really entirely true, but nice try.
Well, they're trying to use it to place marketing, I think. They want to know, should we buy more TV ads geared towards
it's
teenagers?
It's not tracking properly. They say, we got to do something new. Why aren't women paying attention?
No, and that's true. And that's true. And I'm sure they use that for that. But in my day working at studios, I mean, you could almost depend on those numbers exactly to the number. If it said it was going to make 50, it made around 50.
And these days, that's not the case at all.
But aren't they confusing the prediction of the actual firm with, like, the noise on the internet of box office profit and the numbers and anybody who can throw out what they think it'll make? That's not the same thing as their tracking numbers.
Well, no, but if you want to take a look at online, I mean, you guys know that I'm a huge fan of the company Physiology, plug, 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 that there are companies that go online and this is what they do. They scan the internet to see what people are saying. And I would bet that that is more indicative of the real numbers of what a movie is going to make than it would just man on the street.
Well, these days, there's a ton of companies doing it. It used to be just NRG. Now there's OTX, which does most, if not all, of their work online. There's, I think, what is it, MarketCast? And now another firm is starting Screen Engine. So there's all of these firms that are selling this data and trying to compile this data. And they kind of do it through online surveys, and NRG does it through online surveys and talking to frequent moviegoers and making phone calls to frequent moviegoers and talking to them in malls. But really, it's kind of an inexact science.
It'll all become more important once we have this movie betting going on, right? Because that's been approved now, hasn't it?
That's right. We should kind of mention that these movie futures, that one of the two companies trying to get that passed, the, I guess, Federal Trade, the not the FCC, the Federal Trade Commission?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yeah, they got it passed. I guess we'll wait to see whether the Cantor Exchange will be passed as well, but more than likely it will, since one of them... And
I'm not kidding. I had two friends call me and say, hey, what can we place bets on?
Yeah, well, you got to have a lot of money, and you have to really know what you're doing, and you have to be willing to lose your money.
Yeah, don't place your money.
Yeah, I mean...
My advice is good.
I like what one studio marketing official said here. He says, today, any effing moron with an email account can get tracking, and you get plenty of people who don't know how to read the data going around telling people that a movie is going to make $250 million. And
that's what I didn't understand. That's not the tracking firm, so that's not an example of tracking firms being off. That's, again, Joe Schmo getting some raw data and making up a prediction.
Yeah, these Joe Schmoes, though, are working for studios, so people start believing them.
Not, and that's also, I think, a studio exec totally posturing.
Well,
yeah,
probably.
Can I get access to tracking numbers? Because I've never seen any of them for free without paying for it.
Well, probably. I mean, if you know somebody at a studio, yes, you can.
Don't you guys know someone at a studio?
Yeah, we could probably.
They're pretty easy to get a hold of if you really wanted one. That's the sad part.
Yeah. Well, while I make a few phone calls to Disney, Paramount, Warner Brothers, and Fox, I guess we should thank producer Kadi Chubb for taking the time to speak with us about his latest film, Unthinkable, available on Amazon Video on Demand. Of course, you can buy it on Amazon and iTunes. The movie is out now also on DVD. You can probably buy it at, I think, Costco and Walmart is where I saw it. We'll place links to the movie in our show notes, which is also where you can find links to all of the stories we've discussed on this week's episode. The show notes can be found on our website, which is showbizsandbox.com. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts. We've got a Twitter account, which is at showbizsandbox, a Facebook fan page, a YouTube channel. Check them all out and let us know what you think. In fact, you can send us your thoughts, comments, corrections, and kind or not so kind words to our email address.
Kudos,
yes. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And we should mention that if you want us to cover a story, send it to that address and we'll consider it for a future episode. We read all the email that comes in. We also listen to all of the voicemails you leave us at our toll-free number 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Give us a call so we can pretend we're really popular. You might recognize the music at the beginning and end of each episode. It's by MGMT. The popular indie rock group can be found online on their website, whoismgmt.com. They're also playing this week in Oakland at the Fox Theater and in Vancouver at the Commodore Ballroom. Check them out.
By the way, catching up on my Rolling Stones, I saw that MGMT was one of the 40 reasons why Rolling Stones says we still love rock and roll. So congrats to them for that.
Congratulations. Go check them out. You can also check out Huffington Post columnist Michael Giltz, who can be found online at michaelgiltz.com, where he places links to all of the stories he writes for various outlets. He can also be found on Twitter under the eponymous handle at Michael Giltz. Karen Woodward's username on Twitter is a little trickier. It's at Karen_Woodward. But her website is a little easier to remember. It's KarenWoodwardOnline.com. That's where you can find out about all of the social media work she's doing around the internet these days. Some of my stories can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com, a blog that focuses on the world of movie theaters and film distribution. I can also be found on Twitter from time to time. My username is at Sperling.
I'd like to thank my in-studio audience, which is the people of New York who've been walking by me as I stand on the street corner recording this podcast wondering what the hell I'm doing.
Oh, you should put out a hat.
I should have.
Well, until next week, play nice.